This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For 3 years now, financial jargon like IPO, stock option, and vesting party have been intimately associated with a couple of other phrases, irrational exuberance and stock market bubble. Now Wall Street's long drought of red-hot initial public offerings may be over. Google, the search engine beloved by web surfers around the world, appears to be on the verge of one of the largest IPOs in U.S. financial history. Many analysts and much of the tech industry hopes to ride the search engine's coattails to the top of the NASDAQ and reignite an economic rocket. Others are more cautious. We'll take a tour of Google's finances, look at the company's culture and its future, and we'll see how the competition to create the perfect search engine may affect advertising, computing, and your privacy. Are you ready for a dot-com comeback? Will you buy Google stock, or are you worried about a replay of greed and fear? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And with us now to discuss Google's financial standing is John Battelle, director of the Business Reporting Program at the University of California at Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism. He's a prolific writer and blogger, and he joins us from his house in Marin. Welcome, John Battelle.
Thank you for having me.
So why is Google mounting an IPO now?
Well, I think that the shortest answer is they actually waited as long as they could. The news broke late last year that Google, which already was a hotly anticipated IPO even last fall, was going to run out of time under a relatively obscure SEC rule that has to do with filing public statements, even if you're a private company, if you have more than 500 shareholders.
So
it seems they waited till they, you know, absolutely couldn't wait any longer, and that pretty much is this week.
Well, what are the advantages and disadvantages from their point of view about going public?
Well, the advantages, there are many advantages, and they're often obscured by the disadvantages. So we can start with the advantages. One of them is, of course, that you provide a distribution of the wealth to your employees and your investors, who in many cases have been waiting for 5 years, in Google's case, to see some of that value. Another is that it provides the currency in the markets for the company to go out and strategically compete with much larger competitors, such as Yahoo, Microsoft, AOL, and others. Google is a relatively small company compared to those, and all those companies are now aiming squarely at Google for control of a very large search and e-commerce marketplace. Those are a couple of good reasons to go. Now, there are plenty of reasons to not go, and these are the reasons that seem to have been in the forefront of the discussion amongst the founders of Google. One of them is that when you're private, you don't have to be driven by the metrics of Wall Street, and as we've seen in the past, those metrics sometimes drive people to do dumb things. Another is that you can keep your information about your company private and therefore compete by basically through secrecy, so that you have an advantage and you can look at the public statements of your competitors, but they can't look at yours. And also it changes the company culture quite a bit. Expensive cars start to show up in the parking lot, and people tend to leave once they become wealthy, and you don't want to lose your best people.
An article, you mentioned privacy in terms of their finances. An article in this morning's Wall Street Journal described Google as being very secretive. What, if anything, do we know about their books?
Well, there's been a consensus reached by the folks who spend a lot of time kind of reverse engineering the books of private companies. Google has a very strong competitor by the name of Overture, which was recently acquired by Google. By Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
And Overture is a public company, or was a public company, so you could look at its books and kind of make comparisons to Google. And by doing that and talking to customers and so on, the general consensus is that Google is approaching $1 billion in revenue and anywhere from 150 to 300 million in net profits
per year.
Per year.
So the search engine market sounds like it's pretty good.
It's an extraordinarily fast-growing market and also very successful. I mean, when you find a way to connect marketers to the intent of consumers in a way that actually sells products, people tend to pick up that habit pretty quickly on the marketing side. And so that's been proven out, and it's continuing to grow quite rapidly.
Now, we're in a public context where 3 years following the explosion of the tech bubble. What effect is Google going public going to have on the market?
Well, I think the effect, in fact, has already been seen. I think the anticipation of Google's IPO has led a lot of companies to gain some confidence. We've seen scores of filings in the technology sector over the past 6 months. People are not waiting for Google to file their IPOs. We've seen them in the online advertising space, in the technology space, pretty much across the gamut of the same kinds of businesses that we saw in the late 90s. The difference this time is there's not nearly as many what you might call concept IPOs, where you're basically just trying to take an idea public with no revenues.
Mm-hmm.
The oft-compared Netscape is a good example of a concept IPO from 1995-96 time frame. Google is not a concept. Google is a proof.
Well, let's go back to the Netscape example. I mean, they debuted a huge IPO and then were proceeded to be crushed by a certain company based not just outside of Seattle, Washington. And a lot of people say, you know, hey, Mr. Gates is working on search engine stuff, too. Does the same fate await Google?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, it is a compelling, comparison. But there are many things that are different this time around. Number one, Netscape was a very new company going public with almost no revenues in a market that had not yet been established. Microsoft was a very established player that could move quickly to try to create a better product than Netscape's. And most would argue that, in fact, when Microsoft got around to building Internet Explorer, their browser, it was, in fact, a better product. Google has a huge head start in terms of creating a search engine, and it will not be as easy to create a better product. Also, creating a search engine is one of the hardest things you can do in computer science, and creating a browser, while difficult, certainly is not in the same league. So there's a number of things that are different this time around, and I would say that Microsoft is certainly a formidable competitor, but I don't think is in the same position as they were in the mid-90s with Netscape.
If you'd like to join our conversation, right now we're talking about the financial side of all of this. We'll be getting on to different aspects of Google in a few minutes. But our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is John Battelle at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. He's the director of their business reporting program. And let's begin with Russell, who joins us from West Deptford, New Jersey. Hello, Russell. Russell, are you there? Russell has apparently decided to, maybe invest in some stock or something. We'll get on with that.
Going as broker.
Yeah, probably is. And we are expecting this probably sometime this week, right?
Well, there's been some debate about exactly what we're going to get this week. Now, if you're a private company that's been forced by these rules to disclose your financial statements, you have a couple of choices. First of all, you can appeal. Second, which is rare that you'll win that. Second of all, you can file a Form 10, which is a private company filing disclosures of its financials. And third, you can file an S-1 and decide to go public. There has been some reporting in the New York Times in particular that says it may well be possible that Google will simply file a Form 10 instead of filing the Form S-1, which is the registration statement for an IPO. There's been other reporting saying that they, in fact, will file the S-1. So we're not quite sure, but we do expect something this week. One way or the other, we'll learn more about Google than we knew before.
Let's go get a call now. Robert's with us from San Francisco.
Good morning. I'm very concerned about people losing their shirts later. I like Google. I think they do a fine job. But the open source movement is growing and improving with every passing day, and there are search engines such as Demos, which do an excellent job, that also keep out of commercial bookmarks and things, and people can do much better research. Basically, I think people ought to be very wary before investing in something when this other movement is growing and is very underreported.
And in answering, John, would you tell us a little bit what open source means?
Sure. It's a good point. Open source is a software movement, I suppose is the best way to put it, basically allows for code, software programming code, to be free and open to others And there's a community of open source developers which have created some very powerful software that is now competing directly with giants such as Microsoft. Linux is the best known expression of open source software, but there are many others. In fact, Google runs on top of Linux, so you might say that when you use Google, you in fact are using an open source application, but it's an application that has been built on top of the Linux operating system. And the DMOS Open Directory project, which is a project that is edited by tens of thousands of individuals across the web, creating a directory of websites, is not exactly a search engine per se, but a directory, a listing, an ontology of different sites. And that also is incorporated into many search engines. Mm-hmm. So it is not easy to create a search engine on top of open source. Google has done it, and there are other efforts such as Nutch, NUTCH.org, which is an open source-based search effort. But again, when you get to the complexities of search engines, it takes proprietary technologies to get it right. At least it has to this point, and I think that it will continue to in the future. So I don't believe that the open source movement is going to immediately threaten Google's dominance in this space, but I think it will be an important part of it.
Isn't there also, and Robert, by the way, thanks very much for the question.
Thank you.
Isn't there also an advantage in being a brand name? I mean, if you're going to go search for something on the web, you Google something.
Right, and it is a double-edged sword. The folks at Google will often remind you that, you know, it only takes one click to switch from Google to something else. There's nothing keeping you there that's locking you down. On the other hand, Google's an extremely powerful brand that was built with almost no consumer-facing marketing, and that's an incredible accomplishment. Mm-hmm. When you compare the billions of dollars that's been spent to create a brand like Coke. So it does cut both ways, and they're worried that someone might just go to Microsoft's offering or something else if it gets better, and so that's why they focus so much on innovation.
Let's go now to Robin, who's with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hi, I was just curious how someone like myself, who's just a small investor, gets involved in an initial public offering.
You know, that's a good question. I think the short answer is, with something like Google, it's going to be extremely difficult. There are rumors and reporting based on some sourcing, which is anonymous, that say that Google is going to take an approach to the public markets that it will include something like a public auction, which has been popularized by the boutique investment banking firm W.R. Hambricht. And that may allow for some kind of equitable distribution of Google shares, but again, there won't be that many of them. The other way you can do it is if you've got an account with an institutional retail broker like Charles Schwab, you can ask them for a distribution, but again, they will only get a small amount of shares, which they will have to distribute to their investors, and the odds are probably not good for most that you'll get in on the opening share price. Now, the odds are that you can probably get in at the top, which is, of course, what happened in the late 90s.
So what's the difference between, in terms of a price, between getting in on day one, on the IPO, and getting in on day two?
It can be extremely varied. If the stock opens at a price of, let's say, $20, it's not unusual for a very sought-after IPO to double or triple or even quadruple almost immediately. So it can go up to, you know, $40, $60, or $80 pretty quickly. And then when it finds its top, it's, as you know, P.T. Barnum said, there's mm-hmm. one born every day. Someone's going to be willing to buy there. But I would be very concerned about that, because the market is then valuing a company a couple of years into the future. And so you're really buying a futures on a company that has to execute to that price.
Robin, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the phone call.
All right, bye-bye.
And John Battelle, we appreciate your time today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
John Battelle is an author, professor, and blogger. He joined us from his house in Marin, California. When we come back from a short break, we'll be talking more about Google's possible IPO, and we'll be taking a closer look at the history and the unique culture of this company, started in a couple of dorm rooms at Stanford University. That's even before they moved into a garage. If you have questions about how Google became Google, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the company Google and its possible imminent initial public offering going on the stock exchange. Our guest is now Stephen Levy, senior editor and columnist for Newsweek magazine. He wrote the March 29th article, All Eyes on Google. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Stephen Levy, nice of you to be with us today.
Great to be here.
So how did Google get started?
Well, it's a classic startup story. You have two graduate students at Stanford University who have a better idea, and they go to some people and get some money. And sooner or later, they have a company, they move out, and they're on their way.
And it sounds like the American dream.
Well, it's the Silicon Valley dream, and we haven't seen much evidence that's operating on all cylinders. But this week it looks like it's back.
Well, the genius of Google, from what I've been able to determine, and basically what I know about computers, you could squeeze into a thimble. But the genius seems to be they took something that nobody thought needed to be fixed and made it a whole lot better.
That's right. When the World Wide Web first began to get popular, there was one search engine called AltaVista, which turned a lot of people's heads around because it figured out the first way to search throughout the whole web. And, people thought that was it. And there were some small improvements on that. But, it really didn't go all that far. And, that technology really was based on looking at the individual websites and web pages and figuring out which would be most relevant to respond to a search query. So if I was looking for, say, the New York Yankees main web page, it would look at all the web pages on the web and see which one had the New York Yankees most prominently featured within it. And, at first you might go to the right site, but as time went on, other people trying to sell you baseball caps or tickets or...
Or New England furniture, for that matter.
That's right. Would stuff their web pages with New York Yankees. Sometimes they'd put it hundreds of times in invisible type. You wouldn't see it on the web page, and they became less useful. But instead of trying to improve that technology, the companies which used it in the first place were saying, well, you know what? We're going to spend our energy in building these internet portals that people would come to, spend a lot of time in, and we'd have ads on the portals, and we would have sell them email and or give them away and have other kinds of services and headline news and weather, and they would be there, and with a search thing would be a little part of what we do. So it's not really worth the energy it took to improve it. Well, these Stanford guys had a different idea. They said, wait a minute. All this information is online, millions and billions of pages, and there's better ways to search through it. So Larry Page and Sergey Brin came up with some really great ways of using search on the web that went beyond what was on the individual page and actually looked at the behavior of people as they surfed and behavior of other pages. They linked to this page and linked to that page and came up with something that amazingly gave you exactly what you wanted in a very high percentage of searches.
Let's get some callers involved in the conversation. Lynn joins us from Denver.
Good afternoon. Appreciate the program.
Mm-hmm.
As a person who's new to computers, number one, what is a search engine? Number two, what do they do and how can I as a user access them on my computer? And what is Google? I appreciate your time and I'll hang up and take the answer off to you.
Get ready to take some notes, Lynn.
Oh, excellent. Will do. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
A search engine is, a tool that you use to, find what you want on the World Wide Web. You simply use your internet browser, the thing that hooks you up to the web, and, type in the address, in Google's case, www.google.com. Dot is a period if we're getting elementary here. If you like other search engines to try them, there's yahoo.com. Microsoft has its own search engine. There's a number of them. You can even Google search engines and find a lot of them. And, what it does is finds what you want on the World Wide Web. And it's so common to use this particular search engine that Google is a verb. And when you look for something using this tool, you're known to Google it.
And you just there's a little field there, and you just type in whatever it is you're looking for. If you're looking for Yankees and championships, that might get you some pages devoted to those subjects.
You know, there's all sorts of ways to really increase the power of it by, you know, refining your searches, putting in two words, sometimes, you know, words that don't seem to have much in common will really narrow down your search. As a matter of fact, there's a little game that some people play called Google whacking, where they try to, you know, find, you know, a search where there's only one result, and they put two very strange, you know, incongruent words in there. And if you Google whack correctly, you'll get, you know, just one.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have a seminar on Googling later in the program. So Lynn and others, if you want to stay tuned, we'll be giving you some tips on how to work it. Let's get another caller on the line. Brad is with us from Princeton, New Jersey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out that in all this discussion of Google as a consumer service, it's important to point out, as the IPO looms closer, that Google is really two companies in a way, and especially it's two communities of users, because lurking behind the consumer service is the entire suite of Google business services that includes all of their advertising services. This is really how Google makes money. And the competitive landscape is simpler on the back end, on the business side. They have fewer competitors, and they are more in a clear-cut position of dominance. And I think it's important to realize that as far as the IPO draws closer.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little more complicated than it sounds, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. Google is, in a sense, two different companies. There's the front end that people go to when they want to Google something. And then there's the back end, which is populated by business people who are advertising through Google and who are syndicating Google ads on their websites. And that's where the money comes in.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, you know, the caller is right. I mean, we haven't really talked much about the way Google makes its money. And, you know, in some senses, it's similar to the way Newsweek makes its money. And we sell advertising that comes along beside the editorial pages. So you look at the search results you get when you type in a term. It's called a query. And you get, presumably what are the most relevant results, and sometimes as many pages of them. And those are the equivalent to the editorial. And Google is very serious about saying that we're not selling those results, just like Newsweek doesn't sell, advertisers' words in our editorial sections. But alongside those results are, a series of other links. They're not flashing, full of pictures. They're just text links with advertisements that Google sells people related to what the search is. So if you type in skiing equipment, you're going to get some results, on one side, which are the most relevant to skiing equipment. Maybe it's a guide to skiing equipment. And on the other side, the advertisers that have paid most to buy, so to speak, the term skiing equipment will appear alongside. And these things go for an incredible amount of money in certain categories when there's things to sell.
Hmm. Brad, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Bye-bye. Let's try Ryan, and Ryan is with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes. I was just wondering if your guest speaker has any information on the court case that I believe a French pharmaceutical company was taking Google to court over linking their names, something about trademark case or something.
Right, yeah, that's one of a number of cases that Google has had to grapple with, different regulations and rules and laws overseas. And that's an unresolved case. There are other cases that Google's run into problems with in terms of linking, for instance, to Holocaust sites. If you type in, Holocaust denial, you will get a list of sites that deny the Holocaust. And Google's attitude is, well, we're almost like a map maker showing a map of a city. And if a certain building happens to, have something which is very offensive, we just have to report the building. We can't say the building doesn't exist. But in Germany, it's illegal to send a link to these places. And in those cases, in the German Google won't do the link, but it'll provide a note saying we can't do this because of this law.
And it's important to note, I think Google's available in, 90 languages?
It's, well over 100. And, they've been very aggressive in doing it in different languages. And it actually allowed other people to, in an open source spirit, get involved in the translation for new languages.
Hmm.
Just one other question. Do you think that this will have an effect on the U.S. Google site or in trademark law in general?
Well, I think Google's trying to try very hard to provide the most relevant results for any query. So I think they're going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that, in the English language versions, and really any version they can, they give the most amount of information. That's their lifeblood, and that's what the other competitors are going to pound on until they get it right, and they hope better than Google does it. There's a certain amount of vulnerability Google has because it's so popular, because it's the most important search engine. Everybody wants their result to be highest, and businesses live and die on where they appear on the Google search results. So as a result, they try to figure out different ways to, quote, spam Google, to get their names of their businesses higher and higher and higher in the results. And because everyone attacks Google, sooner or later people are going to figure out better ways to do it. So there's this ongoing arm race on how to get your result higher in Google, and people will sell you information on how to do that. And then Google engineers spend a lot of their time trying to make their search results spam-proof to frustrate those same attempts.
Ryan, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
And Stephen Levy, one of the things that some people say is that Google is also vulnerable because it's loosely organized, more loosely organized than a lot of companies. It has an interesting culture. I mean, for one thing, it's based at a place, what do they call it, the Googleplex.
Right, right. And there's a new Googleplex. It's the old headquarters of Silicon Graphics. They moved a couple blocks away in Mountain View. But there's still the same spirit. You go there, and there's Segway scooters. The cafeteria has cooking from the chef of the former chef of the Grateful Dead. The two co-founders, even though they're going to be worth several billions of dollars each, share an office. And, the office is loaded with, street hockey sticks and other kinds of junk. And it really isn't much different from the very first time I visited. I think it was 3 or 4 years ago when they were having a Halloween party. And, one of the founders, now billionaire, was dressed as a cow, and the other was dressed as a Viking. And we went into the conference room, and I had an interview with a cow and a Viking.
So it sounds like Ben and Jerry's West.
And it's still, they try pretty hard to have the same kind of spirit and really try to run it on a decentralized fashion that some people call disorganization. But when I talked to the CEO, a guy named Eric Schmidt, a Silicon Valley veteran who they brought in to be the, quote, adult in the executive suite, he told me that he believes that disorganization is a feature.
By the way, if you want to see pictures of life at the Googleplex, you can visit our website at npr.org. Just go to the Talk of the Nation page. And before we leave you, the future, particularly something called Gmail.
Right. Gmail is sort of emblematic of the way Google is going to expand their services. It's a way of free email, but unlike any other free email service, they're giving everyone who signs up for this, and it's only a test thing now, so you can't sign up without being invited, but soon it'll be open to everyone. They're giving everyone who signs up a full gigabyte. That's, probably half of a library's worth of free storage space. And the reason they do this is they want people to feel free to store all their mail there. And eventually, I believe, people will be able to store their information on Google, because Google wants to have their machines, not people, search that information and send you the ads that are relevant to what it says in there. So, for instance, if you write an email asking someone, hey, what's the best Oriental carpet to buy? Someone who's selling Oriental carpets will be able to have an opportunity to have an ad right there where that email is displayed.
Stephen Levy, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Stephen Levy, senior editor and columnist for Newsweek. He joined us from our bureau in New York. By the way, if you have questions about how best to search with Google or other search engines, we'll be taking questions on that a little bit later in the program. 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR.org and NPR News. And joining us now is Lauren Weinstein, a co-founder of People for Internet Responsibility, which is a private advocacy group. It's very good of you to be with us today.
Hi, it's a pleasure to join you.
And we were just speaking about Gmail, which has created a lot of controversy. Why?
Yeah, my goal here isn't to throw water on the love fest, because I really like Google. I don't know what I would do if it disappeared tomorrow. But what's happened, what gets lost in all of the effusive praise that comes out in these kind of situations about some of their really good products, is that they are also building a vast infrastructure of information that is highly likely to have the potential to be misused in ways that we can't even imagine now. And Gmail is probably the red flag in this that tells us that when the 800-pound gorilla in an industry like search engines, for example, starts collecting lots and lots of information, including email, including your search requests that are logged, all these kinds of things, and has the ability to put that all together in an environment where the laws concerning who can access that information under what conditions are really in flux and much laxer than many people would imagine. It's a matter of some caution that really should enter into this whole interplay of discussion.
So there's a big difference between email you might store now on your own personal computer and email that is stored out there somewhere.
Exactly. And this is something that I don't think most people have any conception of. They just figure email is email. And I should note that this isn't just a matter for Google. Any web-based email service, Yahoo has one, MSN, Hotmail. Anytime you have your email stored in one of these third-party systems, the legal standards for accessing the information change in very dramatic ways. Now, there's court cases that are going to have to hash all this out, but even what we know right now is a matter of concern. And most people don't realize that if they just get their email and it transits through a company, let's say you use a company like, any ISP you choose where they're doing spam filtering for you.
Mm-hmm.
They are reading through your email to search for spam, but then they deliver it to you. It's in transit, so you have a great deal of control over how that information can be accessed, either by a court, by law enforcement, or even just a nosy divorce lawyer, for example,
mm-hmm.
even in discovery proceedings. On the other hand, if you store your email, and remember, Google has changed the whole scale of this. If you looked at the other services, there wasn't enough space to store a lot, so your risk factors tended to be fairly low. When you have a gigabyte of space, you're going to be tempted to put everything there. And as your previous guest was just saying, other information as well eventually. What people don't understand, though, is, for example, if you look at the Google privacy policy, just looking at the law enforcement aspects, they will respond to requests from law enforcement for information. They don't necessarily require a subpoena. They're not requiring a warrant, just a request. That's very different than what happens when you're dealing with information at your own home that's stored on your own home or office PCs.
Well, Lauren Weinstein, thanks very much for pointing out some of the privacy implications of this for us.
Thank you much.
Lauren Weinstein is co-founder of People for Internet Responsibility, a private advocacy group. He was with us from his office in Woodland Hills, California. When we come back from our break, we're going to tell you how to use Google to find out more about your child care provider, your doctor, or even your talk show host you may be listening to. If you'd like to join us with questions about how to search and how best to search, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN@npr.org. We'll also be talking about a new proposal to tax high-speed internet access. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're talking about Google as it apparently begins its approach to going IPO, that's initial public offering, and going on the public stock market on Wall Street. We're discussing its history, its economics and of culture, and of course, its future. And joining us now is Bill Dedman, a reporter for the Boston Globe, who teaches reporters how to use the Internet as a research tool. If you have questions about how to do that with search engines, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN@npr.org. And Bill Dedman, I know you did a little research on me, so what did you find?
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon.
Well, your middle initial is J. We've got that nailed down.
Yep, you got that.
We found in Google, we find only a little bit about what you say about yourselves and what others have said about you. You were held captive in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. And you've won journalism awards. And there's a microchip with your name on it on NASA's Stardust spacecraft.
I knew all those other things. I didn't know that.
Google doesn't find what we might find from the public records, some of which are on the web and some of which, you have to use a telephone or talk to a librarian.
And those are reporters' tools of long-standing value and continuing value, particularly that librarian part. But I noticed that Google missed a few pretty obvious things about me. I wrote a book a couple of years ago. I'm a character in a comic book from time to time.
I missed that one. I saw you wrote a book about baseball.
Yep.
Searching the public records, I find you the address you live in Bethesda, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
You're apparently related to Leanne Hansen, the NPR host, right?
Only by marriage.
Okay. And see how much you paid for your house. I won't tell people that. And your Social Security numbers.
Don't tell people that.
No. Apparently, both you and Leanne lived in Connecticut at some point when you were young.
At different times, yes, that's true.
The median household income in your neighborhood is about twice the national figure.
Mm-hmm. Montgomery County, Maryland.
You're related to someone named Casey.
Our daughter.
And you're both registered to vote in Montgomery County, and you're regular voters. We don't know who you voted for. I won't say which party you're registered in.
Mm-hmm. But you found that out. Interesting, you found our daughter, but not our son, who's a little bit younger.
Yes, he may not have a credit card, may not be on the public record in that way.
Well, all of this took you how long to find out?
I spent about 15 minutes with a service called Accurint, accurint.com, and there are others, KnowX, KNOX.com is a popular one. And these compile public records, individuals buy property, get professional licenses, own a boat, have bought or sold something, these services aggregate that information and allow you to search it.
Well, most of us just go to Google or one of those services and type a search query into the box and take what we get. Are there better ways to do this?
Yes, I think the sort of first thing is to show a little gumption and type in more than one word. I tried it a few minutes ago, China. If you search for the word China, you get 55 million hits on Google. That's that 55 million found that we don't like. Search for China, Yangtze River, Tours, 2005, discount tickets, and you're down to 245 records.
A little bit more manageable.
Or China, Wedgwood, replacement pattern, gravy boat, and you're down to 46. So a boat either way, but a completely different direction.
I was intrigued by your suggestion that, in fact, the best possible result for an initial search is zero.
I like that because it means that I won't waste any more time looking in Google or another search engine because the perfect page I'm looking for isn't out there. Let's suppose you want to know, here in Massachusetts, a big issue now is gay marriage. If you want to know what the law is in every state on gay marriage, don't search for the word law or list or statistics. Search for gay marriage, Missouri, Florida, Alaska. And the first item you find is a page giving you the law in every state, because what we've picked there is words that would be on the perfect page. People often forget that Google doesn't know any words about a page. It doesn't employ any people to write words that describe web pages. At our house, if I wanted to find the piece of paper that was listed what we wanted to buy at the store, grocery list won't do it. We don't write down grocery lists. We write down milk, bread, and eggs, and everybody knows that's a grocery list.
Ah.
So on Google, you search for the words that you insist be on the page, not some broad keywords that might describe the page.
Let's get a listener on the line. Jay joined us from Las Vegas.
Thank you. I've been a writer of letters to the editor in both of our papers here in Las Vegas, even one in the New York Times. And I find that when I enter my name in Google, the references are haphazard to those letters. Some show up, some don't. And interestingly enough, even the ones that show up are misidentified. I'll see my name, and then I'll see not anything from my letter to indicate the nature of the letter, but rather the first few words or sentences of the letter that actually followed mine in those series of letters that were published that day in the paper. So I'm wondering just how can anyone feel comfortable with Google, at least with regard to searching their own identification and information?
That's a good question. One trick you could use is to use not only your name, but some phrase that's unique from your letter, and then the list of items that Google returns will probably show that phrase. But news articles are among the hidden parts of the Internet. They're on the web, but they're not typically found by search engines. The Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, they charge for access to their news articles on the web. And maybe you'll find something for a few days on there, but after a few days, they move it into the paid archive. And Google doesn't find that. It also may not find the
annual returns from companies. You have to go to the Securities and Exchange Commission website to hunt for those. Or a nonprofit organization files a tax return. That you go to GuideStar.org. A lot of information is just not in the search engines because it's information that's returned from a little database search that you might do on an individual government or corporate website.
Jay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Brian, and Brian's on the phone from San Francisco.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Okay, very good.
Good. My question, I'm a graduate business student out here in San Francisco, and I was doing a research project on Donald Trump's hotel and casino industry, just his, that branch of his business. And doing a search on Google, most of what I got was in regard to The Apprentice because it's so popular right now. So I was wondering if there's a way to exclude certain terms or pages from your search.
Yes, all the search tools let you do that. Google's trick for that is to put a hyphen in front of the word. So you might search for Donald Trump and then hyphen or a minus sign on your keyboard, the word apprentice. Minus apprentice means get me anything that makes a reference to Donald Trump but doesn't mention the word apprentice. One handy trick from the front of Google's website, for example, is to click on advanced search, and it lets you fill in little boxes so you don't have to learn this syntax. It's good for people who want to do it without learning it. It's also good for those of us who want to learn the little tricks, because once you fill in those boxes and click to search, you'll see how Google expressed that. You'll see, oh, it's a hyphen, and oh, there's no space after that hyphen. Well, I may remember that, or I may not, and the advanced search page on Google can help you learn how to do that.
Brian,
great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Those of you who want to see, I mentioned the comic books earlier, Bob Edwards, Manoli Wetherill, and I report on Magneto's attack on New York City in Extreme X-Men number 46, available on newsstands everywhere tomorrow, though apparently not on Google. Bill Dedman, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Bill Dedman is a reporter for the Boston Globe and runs a research website for journalist PowerReporting.com, and he joined us from his office in Boston.